This episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Summit, 343's live in-person coaching, education, and networking experience, taking place July 29th through 31st in Las Vegas, Nevada at Palms Resort and Casino. This year, The Summit will be headlined by Hugo Perez, Sasha Vandermost, and Brian Kleiben. Hugo Perez is a former U.S. Men's National Team player and U.S. Youth National Team coach. During Hugo's time with the Youth National Teams, he was widely recognized as having implemented something different, a possession-based style of play. Sasha Vandermost is currently a scout for the Mexican Football Federation. Formerly the Academy Director at Chivas USA, Sasha is the one who brought Brian Kleiben on board at Chivas, and through his leadership, built what came to be known as one of the best youth academies in the country. And 343's own Brian Kleiben, who is now with LA Galaxy's Youth Academy, is continuing to develop players for the professional game with a style and in a setting that is unlike any other in the United States today. Topics at the summit will include individual activities, implementing style of play at team and club level, scouting, session planning, getting parents, players, and club members to buy into what you're trying to do, and more. This is an opportunity to dive deeper into how it's done with presentations from guys who have actually done it. Find more information about the summit by visiting 343coaching.fm, that's the number 3, the number 4, the number 3, coaching.fm, and clicking on live services in the upper right corner. The guest on this episode is Alexi Lawless. And if you're listening to this podcast, it's safe to assume that you know who Alexi is. Now, the other night, while I was on my break at my day job, I was sitting at the bar typing fiercely on my laptop until someone asked me what the hell I was doing. So I told her I was preparing for a podcast interview that I had coming up. She asked who it was, and I said Alexi Lawless, and she responded very enthusiastically with, "Oh my God, I love him. He's so blatantly honest." Now see, people look at Alexi as a speaker of the truth. People gravitate towards him. Something about his red hair must be soothing to American soccer fans. Although he is commonly depicted as a villain, in my opinion, he frequently chooses the underdog. And he is someone who always finds himself in debate. But the people still love him. While preparing for this interview, I thought long and hard about how I wanted to go about it. Do I go in guns blazing with questions about Pro Rel right out of the gate? Do I tell him I'm tired of hearing that MLS is unique? Or do I actually try to get to know the guy like I did with previous guests such as Eric Winalda, Tom Beyer, or Hugo Perez? I chose to get to know him, and I think that I made the right decision. Now, it only took me a minute into this interview to tell Alexi that I don't like him. Because after years and years of watching and listening to Alexi, I've concluded that him and I do not see eye to eye on much of anything at all. And if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I've harassed Alexi for years. But for some reason, he accepted the invitation to come on the show. And for that, I have to give him props. Alexi and I start off by talking about his formative years. He tells me about his first experiences with soccer as a young boy in Greece. He admits that while growing up, he was probably better at hockey than soccer. And he said he was raised in a household that encouraged debate. And all of a sudden, voila, now we have some context. I don't want to spoil the entire episode for you, but I encourage you to listen until the very end. We touch on the 92 Olympics, the 94 and 98 World Cups, and you can bet your sweet little ass that I steer this ship right into the eye of the storm that we call promotion and relegation. The one and only regret with this episode that I have is that Alexi and I were cut short. You will hear an unfortunate, awkward, and abrupt end to our conversation right when I felt like things were getting good. But it's amazing how fast 90 minutes goes by when you're talking about soccer. Off air, Alexi and I discussed the possibility of a round two. I hope he rejoins me someday soon. Because even though we don't agree on certain things, I think it's important that these conversations happen. I think it's important that we're bringing exposure to some of U.S. soccer's most important issues. And I think it's important that guys like Alexi share their opinions. And I think it's important that guys like Alexi make time to hear the opinions of people like you and I. So, with that, I'll get out of the way. I hope you enjoy my conversation with the one and only Alexi Lawless. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the 343 Podcast. A very special guest on today's show, Mr. Alexi Lawless. Alexi, hello.
Hello, John. Thank you for having me on. Pleasure. Not as always, because this is my first time, so I am anticipating pleasure. So it's always fun to talk to people about the game that I think we all love and have a passion for, and have different ways of looking and viewing and expressing that passion, but looking forward to it.
Of course, of course. And one of the things, and we kind of had a little pre-recording banter here, and one thing I think that you're kind of known for is having a view and sticking to that view. And one thing I appreciate about you is that you're willing to interact with people who don't share that view. And I think you coming on this show is another testament to that. And I couldn't be more thankful. I think it's obvious we butt heads on certain mm-hmm. issues, and I guess the reason why I'm so interested in having you on the show is I want to find out more about you and maybe why I don't like you, and mm-hmm. also another big reason is I think you have ideas, and I want to find out where we can find common ground on what we need to do as a country, as fans, as coaches, as players, to win the World Cup, the ultimate goal in soccer. So I think the more and more we have these conversations with people that are from the other side, I think we're going to find more and more places where we have common ground, and those are going to breed ideas that actually get us to our goal. So again, I couldn't be more thankful for you coming on the show. With that, I want to start, like I said, with getting to know you, and not as a player, not as a Fox analyst. I want to know more about Alexi. So can you take us through maybe starting at day zero, maybe, and give us a background of you?
Well, I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit and in Athens, Greece. My father is Greek, and my mother's from New Jersey, and they met here in the United States and produced, among other things, myself and my brother. And so I had what I think would be a typical suburban middle-class upbringing in Michigan. But I also augmented that with spending many of my years when I was younger in Athens, Greece, and two different cultures and obviously two different experiences that I learned and used in different ways. I grew up, you know, eating or chewing bubble gum and watching MTV and drinking Slurpees and being obsessed with music and the Detroit Red Wings and soccer. I went to a very good school. I was fortunate and privileged enough to be able to do that. My father was a professor. My mother was a writer and continues to be a writer. And education was paramount in my household, as was music. And to say that they had a vision of their son growing up to be a professional athlete or soccer player, that was not part of the plan. However, when they saw that it was something that I was good at, it kept me out of trouble and something that I wanted to do, and I was able to keep up to a certain extent my studies, they recognized and supported it. But I didn't grow up in a sports household, and I certainly didn't grow up with soccer parents or sports parents in general. They just they encouraged me and saw that I was good at it and wanted me to do that. I also grew up in a household that encouraged debate and fostered debate about things and having different sides and taking different sides. And I got a lot of that from my father, who was always, throughout my life, very interested in how people saw things and trying to understand different sides, and at times being a contrarian for the sake of argument or the sake of a more robust type of discussion. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed growing up doing that. I think a lot of that has manifested itself in the way that I go about my business today. I don't apologize for that. I think it oftentimes gets to the core of issues and oftentimes brings out interesting sides and forms opinions and maybe changes opinions at times, whether it's your own or others, through that type of stuff. My mother encouraged me to be heavily involved in the arts with regards to music and all the different things that I did. And like I said, I gravitated towards hockey and soccer, and then ultimately to soccer. And I went to university out in New Jersey at Rutgers University. And it was my first exposure to really high quality and a high level of soccer, and made the Olympic team. And the rest is kind of history with regards to the soccer. But that's basically what my upbringing was, going back and forth between Athens, Greece, and Detroit, Michigan, and the two very, very different cultures. I learned to speak Greek, but I was also that, whatever, 8, 9, 10-year-old kid who went down to the corner sandlot in Athens and stood on the sideline, and they wouldn't pick an American, let alone an American who didn't speak English, let alone an American who didn't speak English or didn't speak Greek and had red hair. And I just bided my time until they finally needed a guy at one day, and they put me in, and of course put me in goal. And then I worked my way out and started to speak Greek. And it's where I started playing soccer, in that type of sandlot pickup game type of existence that too often we don't see in the United States enough of.
Do you remember the first time that you played in Greece, or maybe the first time you saw soccer in Greece? What's your first soccer memory over there?
My first soccer memory was my father, my younger brother, and myself going and getting outfitted and getting jerseys of, in that case, the three different teams that we picked for ourselves, and we picked them based on color. My father was Ike, which is a yellow and black type of team, so this yellow thing. My brother loved green, and so he was Panathinaikos, and I enjoyed red, so I was Olympiakos. We all had our affiliations. I had never seen them play. I knew nothing really about the clubs. I was just kind of too young, but that was my first indication of, you know, the existence of professional soccer, and the fraternity, if you will, and the supporters type of culture, an understanding of identifying with a team through color, through history, through family, through whatever it ends up being. And we all had our shirts that we wore, even though we didn't understand much of the history regarding these teams. There was an identification type of process, and yeah, that's one of my early memories of how soccer impacted my life.
And when you're switching back and forth between Greece and Michigan, mm-hmm. were you able to continue that support for the Greek teams? Were you able to follow them in any way? I mean, this is pre-Twitter, pre-internet, I'm assuming. So how were you able to keep tabs?
I didn't keep tabs. I certainly didn't grow up and immerse myself in Olympiakos, and my brother wasn't doing the same thing. You know, I returned from Greece with a rudimentary education when it came to soccer, but a lot of it, like I said, based on kind of pickup soccer, and I played in, you know, school teams and that type of stuff. But then I came back to the United States and lived full time in Detroit, and obviously got into the ubiquitous youth soccer systems. And my father coached, and I played on co-ed teams and all of that kind of youth soccer existence, and that suburban type of youth soccer existence. And so that's where the actual consistent week in and week out playing in an organized format came to be. But you know, I'd still wear my Olympiakos jersey and still identified myself with that, but I wasn't keeping up or let alone watching any type of Greek soccer or any soccer for that matter.
If you were to be watching soccer at that time, do you remember anything about what was available?
Yeah, so that was, you know, maybe videotapes that you bought at the soccer store, or Soccer Made in Germany to a certain extent, but not a lot. And then, you know, the Detroit Express was a team when I was younger that that played out of Detroit, played out of the Silverdome. I vividly remember going to not a lot of games, and I certainly didn't watch them on TV, but going to a couple of games. I even remember one point being able to play before the Detroit Express played on the Silverdome. At that point, it was basically green carpet over concrete. That's what as you know, AstroTurf was back in the day. So, yeah, so those were the limited moments of professional soccer that I saw. The first World Cup I ever saw was in 1986, which would have made me 16 years old. I was at a tournament with my travel team in Boulder, Colorado, and we all gathered around the Holiday Inn pool and had a TV set up and watched Diego and that whole tournament unfold. I was not watching professional soccer. I was not watching World Cup soccer. And you had to seek it out at that point. And so it was very limited in terms of my professional soccer exposure.
When did you realize, I guess, that soccer was going to be a part of your life forever, for the rest of your life? When did that moment come that you knew, okay, I'm pretty good. I'm gonna play professional, and this is gonna be a big part of my life.
Well, I never grew up thinking I was going to be a professional soccer player. It was much more, like I said, geared towards hockey. And I actually played a whole lot more hockey than soccer, probably when you total it all up, at least through let's say 18, so through high school. And I was always going back and forth between soccer and hockey, and the two seasons would happen, and I would immediately just transfer to soccer. And I probably at times was probably better at hockey than I was at soccer, but I really enjoyed the soccer culture, or maybe I didn't enjoy the hockey culture. And as you can imagine, hockey in Michigan it's the law. You have to play it. And I love hockey, still love hockey, and actually still play hockey to this day. But I really gravitated toward the soccer aspect of it because of the international aspect of it. I loved the fact that I was playing a game that I had played thousands of miles away on the other side of the earth, and that there were kids doing the exact same thing, and that was that common thread that we shared. I loved, you know, while I was in this kind of suburban bubble, there was a recognition, maybe it came from going up at times in Athens, Greece, that there was a bigger world than just Michigan. There was certainly a bigger world than the United States, and I was part of it in a strange way by playing that game. And so I love the people, I love the culture. You know, there's a whole generation that grew up kind of identifying as soccer people, and the way that we dressed, the way we talked, the way we held ourselves. And there's a whole bigger generation now that is able to do it, but the soccer people back then in the 70s, 80s, and to a certain extent the 90s, we were a little unique and a little different, but I liked the fact that I was playing a different type of sport than the traditional ones. And I got very good at it. And I knew that if I was going to get into college, soccer was going to help me. I got rejected everywhere. And soccer didn't help me to that extent. My father called up Rutgers University and said, look, I got this kid. He's the number one soccer player in Michigan. And at that point, they certainly weren't recruiting at Michigan. In the state of Michigan, from elsewhere, and certainly not Rutgers, the state university in New Jersey. And he said, what can you do? And the coach said, look, I need to meet him. My father and I drove out from Michigan to New Jersey. I had never been to New Jersey, let alone to Rutgers on exit 9 off the turnpike. And the coach met me and said, look, I can invite you to preseason and I can help you get into the agriculture school. Now, I grew up in Michigan. I sure as hell didn't grow up on a farm, but it was the only thing I had going. And it was the best thing I had going. And I said, fine. And my father then kicked me out, like I said, exit 9 off the turnpike in New Jersey. And I started my career at Rutgers when it came to soccer and my education there, too.
I want to backtrack just a little bit because you had mentioned two different moments in your youth career. And one was when your dad was coaching you, and it sounds like that was more recreational, AYSO, or something of the sort. And then you mentioned, and I think you might have said that was around like age 10 or 11. And then you mentioned something around 16 where you ended up in Colorado with your travel team.
Yep.
And then 2-3 years later, you're at Rutgers. So what was that transition like as a young player? And again, I guess I'm trying to identify like when you started to stand out as, and you identified yourself as the number one player in Michigan, or maybe your dad did. When did you guys realize that's what you were?
I started to, you know, I was always good at the game. And I started to be very good and get recognition within Michigan. My school that I was going to, I went to a wonderful prep school outside of Detroit called Cranbrook, and with just great facilities and a great education. And I started, they had never dealt with an athlete that got that type of success and exposure. You know, I was being, and when I say the best player in Michigan, they vote on the best player every year. And so I was whatever, Gatorade Michigan Player of the Year or whatever at one point. So that's the only anointing that there was of anything like that. But I did the whole transition where, like you said, I was playing, you know, youth with co-ed teams and parents coaching and orange peels and juice boxes. And then the transition where, you know, nowadays it would be, I guess, to academy or a bigger club, but it's basically a transition to travel where instead of playing locally in your community, you're obviously going out and doing that. And that was something that appealed to me to be playing against better players and just the excitement of representing your club and then playing other clubs around the area, and then obviously in the summer all those big tournaments that you have where you play 600 games in 3 days and going from field to field and all that whole soccer type of youth soccer culture that existed. And so that's how I found myself in Colorado at that time, playing for a travel team. The Birmingham Blazers was the name of it, and we would go and play in these big tournaments, whether it was in Ohio or Colorado or different places, and have a good time. And some of my best friends, and still to this day, some of my best friends are players, because I grew up and we went through all these different experiences. And the kicking the ball was all fine and well, and they knew that I was headed into a different area when it came to my ability. But we shared those experiences together, and they became my friends because we met through soccer. And soccer was this connective type of thing for these people that shared a love of soccer, but more importantly, even after the soccer was done being played or discussed, these were my friends. And yes, we identified as soccer players, but it became much more than that in terms of the friendship. But it all started because we saw soccer as something that we wanted to do.
And it's funny when I listen to you and Eric Winalda and some of the guys that played throughout the 80s and 90s and even into the early 2000s, it's almost like it's a fraternity of people that are connected through these just incredible ways. And so I'm curious if your story is anything like Eric's, where he grew up playing with people that then moved on to be either part of the national team or played in Major League Soccer or things like that. So is there anybody from that group of youth players that you grew up with that you are still friends with today that moved on to the next level?
No, I grew up in, like I said, I grew up in Michigan, and there weren't a lot of players coming out of Michigan at the time, and people weren't looking to Michigan as a hotbed of soccer. You know, Eric was growing up in Southern California, and we all know what Southern California is, as you do, the incredible wealth of talent that we have. So that Eric and Kobe, for example, came out of the same area. It's not that surprising, to be honest. And I can't think of there was certainly wasn't one of my contemporaries that came out of Michigan, and I was always the Michigan guy. Even in 1994, when we played the World Cup, and our first game was actually at the Silver Dome. I mean, for me, that was an incredible full circle to come back and play a World Cup in Michigan, in Detroit, in the Pontiac Silver Dome there. And it was, you know, I was this Michigan guy. And oftentimes people would scratch their head and say, how did you come out of Michigan and become a good soccer player or play for the national team? And that's just the way that it was looked at and some of the reality. It's changed a whole lot now. And there's plenty of great talent that, you know, over the years has come out of Michigan and continues to be looked at. But at that point, it was, there just wasn't a lot of talent that either was there, but more importantly, probably the talent wasn't recognized and given the opportunity. I was very lucky in that sense that that Rutgers opportunity came about. And I did everything wrong in terms of picking a college. I did no research. I didn't know anything about it. But like I said, I was at the end of my rope. I had nothing else. And it just worked out great. It was one of those moments that could have gone different ways, and it worked out great.
And again, to kind of revisit that moment where you said you watched the World Cup for the first time with your travel team in 1986. If you fast forward 8 years, you're on the field. What happened in that 8 years that had that massive acceleration from travel team to World Cup player?
Yeah. So even fast forward 4 years, and I'm actually in the stands at the World Cup in 1990. I mean, and my buddies who I was talking about, those same guys that I was talking about that I grew up playing soccer with, we said, look, we love soccer. And at this point now we're all in college. So we love to have a good time and drink beer and travel. So let's get to Europe and let's find a way to get to these games. And we were able to go and see the U.S. play and see Brazil play. And we painted our face, and I was one of what would nowadays be the American Outlaws type of people, you know, drinking and having a good time and just a huge party with my face painted and my buddies traveling around Europe seeing World Cup games. And so between 86 and 90, obviously I finished up high school. I told you about my transition to Rutgers University. Rutgers gave me literally the platform from which I was able to be seen by so many more people, including the national team in the form of the Olympic team, which was gearing up for the 1992 Barcelona Olympics. And so I was identified nationally because we were playing at Rutgers, which was a good quality program and was recognized, especially being in New Jersey, another soccer hotbed, that there was plenty of talent that we were surrounded by. So I became an All-American. I became a captain. I started to get national recognition. I start to get called into these Olympic camps. And like I said, in 1990, in the middle of that college, I go over and spend the summer and I'm watching the U.S. play, never thinking that 4 years later, I would actually be one of those players on the field. And once again, it wasn't as if, okay, I have it all planned out, that I'm going to be a professional soccer player. It wasn't from a young age. And even when I got to an older age, it was, if this is as good as it gets, okay. But there wasn't that expectation that it was going to become a career or a life for that matter.
So what did you want to do? Now I'm super curious. If soccer wasn't like your one thing that you were, you know, dying to be, if you weren't dying to be a soccer player, what was on Alexi's mind?
Well, I mean, look, you have to understand this is back in 1988, 89. 90 in the United States. And so being an American professional soccer player, it could happen, but there were very limited opportunities. This was also during that wasteland after the NASL, where there were, you know, kind of fledgling type of leagues existence, and obviously indoor. And so I certainly maybe had the idea that I wanted to be a professional soccer player, but I had no idea how that was going to happen. And so I was, to a certain extent, resigned to the fact that if I can't find a way to make that happen, you know, I love music, so I think I probably would have been involved much more heavily in music, and you know, been a professor or you know, continued with my education to the extent that I would have, you know, found something that excited me and I had a passion for. But I didn't grow up with the dream of being playing in a World Cup or being a professional soccer player. And that's, I don't say that with any sense of pride. I think it's a horrible indictment on where we were. And it's not as if you could change. It was just the reality of the situation. I'm so glad that this generation that grows up now can grow up with that aspiration to be a professional soccer player and to play in a World Cup. It was a function of the time that I was growing up in and the place and the environment that I was growing up in.
Describe the first moments of walking into World Cup 94 national team camp. Because obviously by that point you knew who the players were. You knew who you'd seen on TV before that, who you went watching the 1990 World Cup. Obviously, these are guys you probably looked up to, or at some point had watched on TV or on the field. What was it like for the first time going into that camp?
All right, so to finish out the development, I play in the 1992 Olympics. I am the Herman Trophy winner from college, so I have recognition. I have national recognition. I've been called into the Olympic camp. I play in the 92 Olympics. The core of that team then transitions to the full national team awaiting the arrival of the 1994 World Cup. So myself, Kobe Jones, Mike Lapper, Brad Friedel, Mike Burns, these types of players, Chris Henderson, were all invited into residency in Southern California down in Mission Viejo, where there was an actual camp that was set up because so many of us, while we played in the Barcelona Olympics, we weren't professional. And so basically what happened was because there wasn't opportunities, the United States Soccer Federation said, look, in order for us to compete in 1994, we need to have an established year-round camp where Bora Milutinovic, the then coach, can see these guys. So he brought us in, and it was sink or swim. And guys came in, and guys went out. And you were on month-to-month contracts, and either they picked you up for another month or they shipped you out. And after 2 years of that, if you were still standing in the summer of 1994, then things had gone well. But that was my existence for 2 years, and all we did was play international games. And I'm coming into a national team, like you said, that in 1990 I was watching from the stands. So I'm sitting next to Tony Meola and John Harkes and Eric Winalda and these types of peoples and of players and people. And I'm in awe of them to a certain extent, but I'm also frothing at the mouth, saying this is my opportunity, and I'm going to knock one of you guys off, and I'm going to take this for myself, especially with the 94 World Cup and the unique aspect of that being played in the United States looming large in front of us. That was a huge, huge carrot. And John Doyle was my competition, and he was the starter for the 1990 World Cup team. And I came in and I said, I'm taking his job. And ultimately, that's what happened. But when I stepped on the field in 1994 as a 23, 24-year-old soccer player in front of a billion people in a World Cup, I had never been on the books of a professional club. And so I kind of did it backwards ass. And I wasn't the only one. It was just, like I said, the reality of our situation. All of my experience was international. That's why if you look at our generation, we have ridiculous amounts of caps, because that's all we did for a number of years in residency was travel around and play international games. And then, but I had no experience from a club perspective, and I just, a lot of it, we winged it, and we kind of figured it out as we went along.
What was the frequency that you guys were playing those international matches?
Almost every week, because that was also before blackout dates and stuff. So it was basically anything that you could set up, you did. And obviously, there were tournaments through the summer, and we would play in. So, for example, we played in Copa America in 1993 down in Ecuador. US, what we called US Cups back then, which is where we played, for example, England and Foxborough and Germany and Chicago and all these different games. So summer there was a whole lot of meat because teams were in. But then all through the year they would just set up these games, or we would go to Japan, or we would go to other places. And obviously we didn't have to qualify because we were hosting the World Cup, so we didn't have a qualifying process to go through either. So the first real competitive game that we played was the World Cup. To a certain extent, I guess it's not ideal in terms of preparation, but given what was the reality of the moment in that situation, there was some foresight in establishing that camp. And I don't think it's any coincidence that a lot of the players that we saw emerge in the summer of 1994, like myself and Kobe, had been part of that camp for the last 2 years. And we learned a lot. But it was 2-a-days every single day, and then playing internationals on the weekend or traveling to play internationals.
Did you have a mentor on the 1994 team when you first came in? Like you said, those guys, John Harkes, Winalda, Miola, they had been there and been established in the US program. Did anybody take you under their wing, show you the
No,
ropes?
no, no. And not because they felt threatened, but at that point, you asked, did you know what you wanted to do? Well, once I get to that position, I can see a pathway to success and to something big and important. And more importantly, I wanted it. So, and look, I'm not telling you anything. You know that team was made up of big personalities, and I was part of it immediately. Oftentimes, people think that I played in the 90 World Cup because they just kind of lump us all together. But I came in there all guns blazing. And I was the way that I looked, the way that I played, it was designed to be bigger than life, and it was designed to intimidate, whether you were the captain of the team or whether you were anybody else. And so I just became a part of that core of leaders, even though I hadn't been part of the 1990 team, but nobody took me under their wing. And it was, to a certain extent, yeah, it was, I guess it was cutthroat. Nobody was mean to me. they probably were a little scared at times of me, but also nobody was patting me on the back. Although Bruce Murray was very cool to me. And I'll never forget him saying, after I had scored a goal, look, you keep doing that and some good things might happen. And they did happen.
What goal was that?
I scored a goal against Colombia or something down in Miami. And we were coming up to play against England later on. And I wasn't getting a whole lot of playing time. And he said, hey, you get on that field against England and score a goal, things might look up for you. And I actually did, and I scored against England. And that was the start of a whole lot more playing time. And Bora Milutinovic, who literally broke us down to build us back up individually and collectively, and to this day is a really important component of my development, because he came along just at the perfect time. As frustrating as he can be, I needed that at that moment, and he made me a better person and a better player going through that 2 years under him.
I just had a crazy thought, and it never even occurred to me, because I didn't realize that you guys were in such like a camp setting with friendlies every week. But the American soccer way, and still to this day, it's recreational and even into the competitive circuit, is based on tournament play and playing as many games as you can in a short amount of time. In that camp setting, were you guys playing games with that mindset, or like trying to cram it like two games into a weekend, or things like that?
I don't think so. I think just we could only, you know, we were whatever we could schedule. But unless we played an actual tournament, as we did, for example, like I said, the Copa America 93 and those U.S. Cups, where they were in almost a tournament type of setting, we didn't get that that conditioning of playing every third or fourth day that the teams kind of need to understand how to go through a tournament. But we played a lot of them. And when I look at the numbers of internationals that myself and Kobe and different players had, by the time we got to that summer of 94, it was ridiculous. And Boro was very good at playing every different type of team. So we would play Scandinavian teams. We'd go down and play South American teams. We would go over and play Asian teams, all different types of teams to get us, in that sense, conditioned. But we didn't space them out in a tournament type of mirroring any type of tournament setting.
I want to fast forward now to the 98 World Cup and preface with, you have a really, really good chat with Steve Sampson on your podcast, which is the Mutant Gene podcast.
Mm-hmm.
That's Mutant Gene and on iTunes, and you can find it.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. So Steve Sampson, the coach during the 1998 World Cup and leading up to the 1998 World Cup, your chat with him, and you actually have a follow-up episode, I believe, saying that you kind of just let Steve talk and didn't want to interject. I'd like to pick your brain with and get your thoughts of how some things went down. I have the nice experience of having Steve coaching in my backyard now. I live in San Luis Obispo, and he coaches at the local university here now. But I guess I'll start with this, and it's a question I asked about you in the 1994 World Cup. If you had a mentor going into that one, going into 1998 with the experience that you had under your belt with the Olympics now, and a World Cup, was there anybody that you took under your wing in 1998?
No. And like I said, it wasn't, I mean, national team is also a little bit different than a club situation. And by that time now, we had been through club. I had gone over and played in Italy. Like you said, I had done Olympics in 92, World Cup in 94, also Olympics in 96 in Atlanta. I was one of the overage players. And so now, this was going to be the culmination, 1998. So now we had experience. Now we were going to use it. All of us were in our prime from an age perspective, me being 28, which oftentimes is referred to as the prime. So now we're using all of that collective experience and individual experience that we've had to really show that we've progressed since 1994. And, you know, I was excited. I think the team was excited because we were better. there was a better collection of talent. Now, how that talent was put to use, that I think was the problem. And look, there were problems before we ever landed in France that were not sorted out. And ultimately, I take responsibility and I can only do it for myself. I can't say other players do or don't. But I take responsibility because of the way that I acted and the things that I did, and ultimately the lost opportunity. And John, you know that this soccer is at times very fragile in the United States, and we cannot afford to let opportunities go to waste. And 1998 was a wasted opportunity. Was it the end of soccer? No. And almost you can sometimes argue that we almost needed to go through that to get to something like 2002. But I don't think we needed to go to it, and I think we didn't put our best foot forward, and that was a waste. And I was part of contributing to the situation that existed where we wasted that opportunity. And to this day, I regret few things in my life, but I regret that I was part of that because I love this game, and I never want to be something that is detrimental to the evolution and the progress of the game. And that summer, with what we did, and certainly the way that I acted throughout it, not just that summer, but even beforehand, we didn't help the game move forward. And I will regret that forever. And I talked, like you said, to Steve Sampson, and we all have our different versions of the truth and what did happen, what didn't happen, how much of an impact it had, how much or didn't have. But ultimately, you know, we were responsible for bringing that soccer, that American soccer, to the masses and putting on a good show that summer, and we didn't. And that hurt soccer, and it hurts me that I was a part of it.
When you say we, are you talking about the guys on the field? Do you feel like you guys should have taken more responsibility and just and whatever lineup Steve Sampson put out there, it was up to you guys to put on the show, or are you including Steve in the we?
No, I don't want to speak for anybody, but when I say we, I mean everybody. And so, yes, the coaching staff and myself, we were the team that was responsible for what happened on and off the field. And we can justify it. We can talk about who was more to blame or less to blame, but that doesn't change the fact that it's, once again, that wasted opportunity. And it never should have gotten to the point that it did get to. And obviously, it's going to rear its ugly head at the worst possible moment, and it did, and it manifested itself over time. And we let it happen. I let it happen. And at times, I probably was responsible or part of the deterioration of what once was good. Because keep in mind, in 1995, we went down to the Copa America in Uruguay and had a historic performance. And we were heading in the right direction. When Steve took over, he really let the reins off and really let us do what we wanted to do. And so we were feeling our oats, and we were growing each and every year. We cruised through qualifying without a problem. We had that wonderful result down in Mexico City, getting a tie during the hex. All of these wonderful things were happening. We were all coming off of our European experiences. Many of us had returned to MLS. All of these wonderful things were happening. And then the summer of 98 really kind of just punctured that balloon, and like I said, was not fun to be a part of, but also it was embarrassing, and in my perspective, shameful that it happened.
Pardon me for trying to dig a little bit deeper, but what is it? It happened. You were part of it. What do you think that it is?
So obviously the results on the field, finishing last, not getting out of your group, losing to Iran, and obviously losing to Germany, which is, there's no shame in losing to Germany or anything like that. The infighting that became outfighting, the way that we talked about each other, the way that we talked about Steve, and the implosion of that team on itself, and how that was played out in the press. And it didn't need to happen. And like I said, you know, you can assign blame all over the place. Did Steve pick the right players to play? Was it the right formation? Did he misjudge the situation between Eric and John Harkes? And did that affect people more? Should he have done something? All these different things. Should, you know, I wasn't I wasn't starting. There came a point where I wasn't starting. Did I handle that in the correct way, in the mature way? And I can honestly say no. And, look, none of us ever got anywhere without a big old beautiful ego. And I have no problem admitting that mine was and continues to be big. But I also look at that at times as a tool that can be used to my advantage and as a resource. But it also can lead you to do and say things that you may regret. And like I said, but it comes back to this was avoidable. If we had dealt with these issues earlier on, they wouldn't have manifested themselves that summer and been so problematic.
Let's come back to 98 in just a minute, but this sounds eerily similar in ways to what happened with Jurgen and Landon recently, or more recently. Mm-hmm. What was going through your head as you were watching all of that drama unfold? Were you like, oh shit, this is happening again? Or did you, I guess, what was going through your head?
I thought that I have no problem with the national team not having Landon Donovan in 2014 on the roster. All right, you make big calls and whatever. So and we can argue as whether he's good enough or whether he would have helped and stuff like that. What I do have a problem with is Jurgen bringing him in and in this theatrical way, then cutting him right before the World Cup. I think that was cruel and unusual, especially to a player who has meant so much. And I think it was unnecessary. And so that's one of the things that I think could have been cut out at the pass. If you don't want Landon Donovan after he takes his sabbatical or something, then say, no, it's done. It's over. And we've moved on. And thank you very, very much. And you cut it off well before it ever gets to the point where you're then bringing him in only to cut him. Okay, because that to me is ridiculous. Either he's good enough or he's not good enough. So that was going through my head. Also, what was going through my head was I hope that the Landon Donovan story doesn't infect internally or overshadow the job that is at hand. And, you know, you talked about the John Hark situation, which certainly impacted internally everything that we did. And it was something that we talked about and something that I think was much more impactful than maybe Steve Sampson thought it was going to be.
But Alexi, if I remember right, you guys as players didn't know the reasoning behind Hark's being sent off.
Yeah.
But with Landon's being so public, I mean.
Yeah. So the reason behind the dismissal of John Hark's was, I think, known to few. I was oblivious, so I didn't know what was going on. And I thought it was ridiculous, but I'm going to go on and do my job. But I didn't know what was happening. The Landon Donovan thing, like you said, especially it's happening in 2014 and all the instant notifications and all the news that's out there at your fingertips. So this nothing is going to go under, be swept under the carpet or go under the radar when it comes to the information out there. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It was a little bit different situation in just this story of, look, they're not bringing one of the greatest, and in my mind, the greatest male American soccer player ever to play the game. Why is he doing something like this? And he could have dealt with it much, much earlier. And I think in a much better way.
Going back to that fraternity of guys that have been, in a way, kind of like the founding group of modern day U.S. soccer. I guess you could start that with 1990, maybe more so 1994. You guys are all still very well connected, it seems, with you, Eric, Kobe, and the likes of that group. Were you guys talking about that situation going down with Landon amongst yourselves? Do you guys have those conversations on a personal level?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how many of those guys are still involved and in a very public way in soccer. I mean, you go through the line, you know, Tony's coaching, Fernando Clavijo's down at Dallas, obviously myself, and Marcelo Balboa continue being involved in media. Paul Caligiuri has coached and been involved in media. Mike Sorber continues to coach. Kobe Jones, who we've talked about, Eric Winalda, who we've talked about, all of these different, and John Harkes, who's coaching, and all of these different guys are still very much out there in the public when it comes to soccer. Yeah, we talk about it when we see each other. Sometimes we text back and forth with what's going on. And so, yes, there is a type of fraternity and a based on a shared experience. But we also recognize that we have different opinions on different things. So it's not as if we all get together and say, you know, what the hell is this coach doing, or this coach, or why is this player doing this, or anything like that. That's not really how it works.
I guess I'm more so wondering, I've asked, I think, two questions now about mentorship, and at what point does somebody who's been through this situation step in and try to talk to the current players and give them a past player's perspective on how to handle something? Like you said, you admit you handled it poorly. When does somebody like you step in and tell maybe the next generation, like, dude, what the hell are you doing? Just chill.
Yeah, I find myself mentoring or being mentored more in my capacity now in broadcasting and in media. People come to me much more. And whether it's the actual TV side of it or the soccer side of it, it changes. But I think when you're actually a player, and when you're a player like I was, I think it was just harder to be involved in any type of mentoring capacity. Now, I put my arm around players when I was a player at different times and told them the lay of the land, or put them up against the wall and explained the situation and what they were doing was wrong at different times. But you also just have to be careful to pick and choose your moments when you do that. And it's much easier to do it now once I have some distance away, and they don't feel threatened or anything when I'm giving them any type of advice. And I rarely do it unsolicited. So a lot of people call me or seek me out all the time nowadays, players and people that want to either get into the business or just players in general to kind of just talk about different things. And if they want to talk and if they want my advice, I'll give it to them. But I don't want to be that old guy that's coming out and saying, get off my lawn, or back in my day, we used to run through the wall or stuff like that. No, that's not what I would want in that situation. And by the way, when you're young, you rarely listen anyway. So
very true. let's jump back to 1998. And again, with your conversation that you had with Steve Sampson and start to connect the dots to, what you're up to these days. And I find it very hard to believe that anybody listening to this podcast right now does not know who you are and does not know what you do today. Mm-hmm. And probably is well-versed or somewhat well-versed in your past as well. But now you're at Fox. Yep. Analyst, commentator, what's the official title, I guess?
Yeah, I guess analyst.
Analyst.
Opinionator, I don't know.
Of course.
Provocateur, I don't know.
Yeah, and yeah. I have a question about that that's going to connect those dots too. But so analyst now and on the media side for sure. But then jumping back to 1998 and the conversation you had with Steve, you were kind of critical of his opinion of how the media played a role in what ultimately happened in France in 1998. Steve seems to think that the media played a big role and maybe gave fans and maybe even players unrealistic expectations going into or maybe at the World Cup.
I mentioned the fact that over the course of Steve's tenure, we had done some very, very good things. So I don't think that the expectations were unrealistic, that we could go and we could compete even in a group with Germany, Iran and Yugoslavia.
But Steve thought that though.
So this is my rebuttal to Steve. And like you said, the following week, I talked about some of the things that Steve had mentioned. I also don't buy the fact that the the media that was covering this team was naive. While there was less of it, I firmly believe, and I will submit, that they were as invested and as knowledgeable, educated about this team as anybody that exists today. And it was their responsibility to report on many of the negative stuff, things that were happening, especially when that team started to implode. And so I just disagree with Steve when he says that it was a function to us, not completely, but there was an element when it came to the media that he felt either the expectations were too high or they were giving a distorted type of view of what this team was on a day-to-day basis or just in general.
So I want to connect a dot now. Now you're on the media side, mm-hmm. and USA is playing Argentina.
Yep.
Pre-game, I would say the majority of the panel on Fox chooses USA to beat Argentina.
Yeah, 3 out of 4.
3 out of 4. Is that unrealistic?
No, not at all. It's happened before. It's happened even against Argentina. Even in a Copa America, 20 years before, or whatever, 20, no, less than 20 years. Yeah, no, 22 years before, in 1993. The U.S. has beaten big teams. The U.S. has beaten big teams in tournament settings, like I mentioned, Argentina in a Copa America. Let's see, Spain in a Confederations Cup, Colombia in a World Cup. You know, the list goes on and on. Does it every single time? No. But I was reflecting, yet an optimism that, you know what, maybe this is the moment when another one of those things happens. It's not unprecedented. I've been accused of being overly patriotic in that pick or biased in that pick. First off, we're all biased to a certain extent. We all bring our baggage. So there's nothing that any human being can do about that. I was accused by my colleagues and friends, I should say, Colin Coward, over there, and Jason Whitlock of lying to the American public by having the audacity to pick the United States over Argentina. And I joke about that with him, so I'm not having a shot at him or anything like that. But the reality was that I thought that this was that moment. This was going to be that moment. Obviously, I was wrong. But to take me to task for picking the United States in that type of situation, you know, what if I had picked the United States against Colombia in the World Cup? People were talking about Colombia as the favorite to win the World Cup in 1994. What if I had picked the United States against Argentina in the Copa America or Spain, the number one team in the world in Confederations Cup? So that's where my pick came from.
Yeah, but
if you look at my history when it comes to talking about soccer or picking, that I will pick whoever I feel is appropriate, regardless of my red, white, and blue and belief and love for this country.
I guess you mentioned it was an optimistic pick. So is that what you're going on? Maybe there's a chance that USA is going to beat Argentina this time because we've done it in the past, or is there specific evidence that you're looking at that this group of players matches up well against what Argentina can bring to the field?
Yeah, this team had rolled after the initial loss to Colombia, had rolled on. Yes, they were missing some players and some crucial players at that. But I felt that Jurgen Klinsmann was in charge of a team with more depth than any team in the past, a team that was now cruising and was confident, a team that was playing in 2016 in their own country as the host. And yes, they're playing against a very, very good Messi team. And I figured that they would go out and play from a tactical perspective, play a game that recognized that they were not going to have a lot of the ball and that it would be, in that sense, a more traditional type of American performance. Unfortunately, what ended up happening, as everybody who saw the game, was not only did they not, to use Jurgen Klinsmann, play a more proactive type of approach and take it to the other team, but they also didn't do the other thing. And so they were stuck there in the middle where they didn't press and they also didn't absorb. And you do that against just a mediocre team and you're going to pay, and you certainly do it against an Argentina team in 2016 and you will pay dearly, and they did.
It's incredibly difficult to compare the 1998 World Cup and what's widely talked about as a failure.
Yep.
And I don't mean that in a rude or bad way, but and compare that to a 2016.
Oh, it's okay. No, everyone gets scared of the failure. Yeah. I have no problem with failure. It's okay. I've failed a lot.
For sure, for sure. And I don't mean that in a bad way. but it's incredibly difficult to compare the 1998 World Cup with the expectations that you guys had going into that tournament with what seemed to be similar going into Copa America 2016 for this USA team, where there was this belief that we were going to make a run at it. Mm-hmm. Which one... Well, I mean, okay, so give me your opinion then.
Yeah, I don't think that there's look, there's a time difference, and so theoretically, given all of that time, we should be in a much better place, right? I mean, I know it doesn't always work that way, where it's just a constant type of growth, and there are ups and downs. I understand that, but theoretically, if in 1998 those were the expectations, then I would think in 2016, given the experience that the players have, given the coach that we have, given the success that we have had, and given the fact they're playing in the United States, yeah, I don't think it was unrealistic, I guess is what I'm getting down to. Was it ambitious? Yes, but this is where I will get into red, white, and blue. And I know I get sometimes taken to task for it, but I believe that a national team is a reflection of its country and of the philosophies and of the character and the personality within that country. And one of the things that has made us great is being able to do things that people don't believe can be done. And that, I think, has to be represented in the way that we go about and in our expectations. So I don't think that it was, like I said, unrealistic expectations. That they didn't do it, but it also doesn't mean that because they didn't beat Argentina in that particular game in 2016 in Copa America, it was a failure.
Was the tournament as a whole a failure? I mean, you guys are really critical about your performance in 1998, and yep. and I think what Whitlock and Coward kind of took you guys to task on, or soccer media to task on, is that we aren't hard enough on the players. Uh-huh. And yeah, was the tournament a failure?
I don't think that, well, the tournament as a whole was an incredible success. But from the U.S. perspective, I think the reason why I could make an argument that it was a failure was because specifically of that Argentina game. And it's not even, you can lose to Argentina. There is no shame in losing to Argentina. The shame is in the way that you lost to Argentina. There was no fight. All of those things that we've talked about, which is one of the reasons why the expectations were increased over the last 20 years, none of that was on display. And that, I think, was what was disappointing to a lot of people, is that you at least got to put up a fight, and it looks like they didn't even put up a fight. And they were outcoached. They were outplayed. Physically, they were dominated, which is inexcusable. And ultimately, from a scoreboard perspective, it was, again, and to go back to what I talked to earlier, a wasted opportunity. And so many people, even your Jason Whitlocks and your Colin Cowards, were coming into the tent, even maybe for the first time since they saw Tim Howard stand on his head in 2014 during the World Cup. So this was their first re-exposure to this team. And after that game, they said, oh my goodness. Maybe some of them even said, we've regressed after watching that performance. And that, so once again, was a wasted opportunity. And in that was a failure.
But if you look at it only Argentina, though, didn't we lose more than one game?
Three games. Yep.
So how can we look at just one game and say that that was the only failure when we lost three games, two to the same team?
Yes. So the Colombia games is what you're mentioning. So obviously we bookended the tournament, starting out against Colombia, losing. And that was a horrible performance. And then you have a third place game. And I think that was a wasted opportunity. So yeah, you're even more making my case maybe that it is a failure. However, I think getting to a semifinal of a Copa America in 2016, that can't be dismissed. and that there is a value to doing that. But once again, we're still left wanting. And maybe that's just, once again, America, that's how we go about it, and that it's never good enough unless we are the champion and number one. That's what's made our country great and ultimately what will make our team great. Or if you may argue, is just unrealistic expectations. I don't know. But yes, you are right. When you look at the wins and losses, two losses to Colombia and obviously a loss to Argentina, you could make a case, and I certainly could make a case, that it was a failure because of those wasted opportunities.
Now, here's where I'm coming from with this, and I'm not trying to talk out of my ass, but I'm tired of failure. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of the buildup and the hype and the expectations. I mean, I get my hopes up from time to time. I try to stay realistic in a sense, but I do follow that hype train at certain times. And when something like this happens and we get to the same result every time, where it's kind of like crash and burn almost. How do we fix this? How do we hit the next level as a soccer playing nation? How do we fix this problem?
Well, okay. First off,
I know this is a tall order.
I love talking about this, this is something that you, myself, we all think about, and none of us have. Well, we all have different theories as to how to fix it. So these are all theories. In practice, who knows if they ultimately work? I think that, once again, going back to talk about our country, what makes our country great is its diversity. But what makes a country great might not always be the best thing for making a great soccer team. And in that, I say one of the things that we may have to look at is recognizing that because we come from such a diverse country, it means that there is an incredible diversity in the way that people think about this game. And there are many people that see beauty in the game in very different ways. So what is beautiful play? What is success? What is a good player? What is a bad player? What is entertaining? What is attractive? All these different things. If you go and ask players or coaches, it's going to be relative to the experience that they have, the baggage that they carry, whether it's geographical or cultural. Or from family, all that different stuff is going to go into how they describe how the game should be played. And when you do that, you come up with many different templates. And deciding on a template, I think, is crucial to going forward. Sometimes we try to be everything to everybody because that's the American way. And I know it scares people, but the fact is, I think going forward, we are going to have to be more exclusive, or exclusionary, I guess you would say, as opposed to inclusive. And as I said, that scares people because that is almost anti-American. And yet, from a pure soccer perspective, having players that are of like minds, having players that have shared experiences and that think about that game when they are asked those questions and think about it in the same way can be a more direct route to success. And so that's why I argue that at times maybe our best chance of success if you wanted to have it quickly would be to take a national team all called from Southern California or all taken from New Jersey or some place where many of them have played against each other, have grown up in the same types of systems and understand the game and think about the game in the same way. That's one theory that I have talked about over the years. And I think while there's different levels of it and how much of it or little of it you tend to go, I do think that being able to articulate and define a set style of this is how we are want to play and recognizing that in doing so, there are going to be some very, very good players that just don't fit and not being scared of that, I think that that can lead to success going forward.
I mean, when you start talking about excluding, yep. I want to know who. I want to know specifically how you would go about excluding people. And also, when you say things like, you know, a team from Southern California or a team from New Jersey, I think the easiest way to go about something like that, it'd be really hard to choose a national team from one area of the country. But I think that opens the door to a conversation about choosing a national team from just Major League Soccer. And I don't know if that's good.
Yeah, I don't know. And once again, this has nothing to do with when you're picking that team. It's much more about geography than it is about, culture or your ethnicity or anything like that. It's about having a group of players that all think about the game in a similar way. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. And you asked, so who would be excluded? Well, ultimately, it's based on whatever your criteria and your template is, where you say, look, this is what a right back looks like, and this is how we want our right backs to play. If you can adapt and be that type of player, great. If you can't and you play a different way, guess what? You're not going to be considered. And it doesn't mean that you can't be a good right back at a different team or something else. But if you're going to be a national team, this is how we are going to play. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. But once again, trying to fit everybody in and trying to take all of those different templates and kind of mesh them all together, I think it can be done. It's going to take a whole lot more time and resource and effort. And maybe that's something that we just have to come to grips with, that in order to be a proper reflection of our society and our culture, it's going to take a whole lot more time to meld all of those together into that unique melting pot type of reflection on the soccer field.
Would you exclude the foreign players, that foreign-born players, I guess you could say, or players that are playing in Europe? Or
No.
Sounds like when you talk about like the geographical location, it sounds like these guys are coming from an area that's foreign to the way maybe the majority of the team looks at it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to be very, very clear. No, I wouldn't. I was just giving you an example, because oftentimes when people ask me about this theory, I just use Southern California as an example, because if you're building a team just from a certain area, but it doesn't have to be just from the certain area. It can also be just like-minded individuals. So I don't care where you play, where you grow up, what your ethnicity is, but if you think about a position, or you think about a team, or you think about the game in a way that other players do, then maybe you have the criteria and the qualifications to fit this template that we have laid out. So yeah, I don't care where you're from. Now, it might be more difficult if you grew up in a certain type of area or a different country or something like that, and have a different experience to if you're not already doing it and playing in that certain way that you want to play, that's referenced in that template, to adjust. But you know what? We adjust all the time. And I think really good players are able to adjust. But I just think that there isn't a template right now. And maybe, maybe this is all bunk and there is no template and there shouldn't be a template with regards to how America plays. But if you're asking me the quickest way to get a successful team, and look, you're a coach, you guys understand what coaching is about, and I don't want to put words in any coach's mouth, but having a consistency and an understanding and a communication and shared experience, I think that that can help in terms of putting together a successful team.
No, and I completely agree with that. Before I lose this train of thought, we sit here at our computers and on podcasts and on TV shows and whatnot, and throw around all these ideas. Like I asked you, how can we win a World Cup, right? Mm-hmm. The same people have been at the helm of U.S. soccer for X amount of years now, and at the helm of the Division I of our domestic league for X amount of years now. We talk about all these ideas. How does somebody come in to present these types of ideas, or maybe inject themselves into a U.S. board position, or run for U.S. soccer president? And this is an election year for the United States. Every 4 years, we have to elect a new president, or elect the same president again for another 4 years, but 8 years max, right? How does U.S. soccer get these new ideas and move forward if we have the same dinosaurs at the table?
Well, first off, there's an easy way to get rid of any of these quote unquote dinosaurs, and that's just anybody can run. You can figure it out. You could run, and you could be elected. So, I don't quite understand what the question is then with regards to the people in charge.
Yeah, I guess who you're a U.S. soccer veteran involved in the media. Who ran against Sunil Gulati last time?
Exactly. So, I mean, Sunil Gulati is very, very good at amassing power and to using that to continue to stay in his position.
Is that good for U.S. soccer?
Is it good for U.S. soccer? Yeah, I think ultimately, while I may disagree at times with what Jurgen Klinsmann has done, what Sunil Gulati has, some decisions that he has made, I think that Sunil Gulati has been good for U.S. soccer. Now, I think you're asking, how do we either get different people with different ideas, or at least those different ideas involved? And I don't necessarily think that U.S. soccer is deaf to new ideas or doesn't want new people involved. But from a practical standpoint, somebody has to run the federation, and somebody has to be making those decisions. Now, the trickle down of those decisions, and this gets back to that template. So let's say they do decide on a template. Then having everybody understand it, and more importantly, having somebody that is able to articulate it consistently so that everybody around knows that this is how the federation is, whether you agree with it or not, doesn't matter. I much rather have a flawed plan than no plan at all. I always say that because too many people wing it. And if that template were and everybody understood that this is how you are going to play for the national team, this is how all the national teams are going to play, this is the position that we are taking, and this is the path that we are taking. But being able to articulate that is another thing. But if you are able to do that, then you would have other coaches saying, look, if I want my players to play and have a future for the national team, this is how they have to play, then that's what they are going to do. Or they're not, or they're going to say no. And then, you know, you have to get somebody else in there that has a different idea.
And to a certain extent, I feel like Claudio Reyna's efforts to put out that U.S. soccer youth training curriculum a few years back was an effort to unify the vision of all of these coaches across the United States that are reaching, you know, 10-year-olds to 8-year-olds and to give U.S. soccer that vision.
Now, do they want to be unified?
There we go. That's one question, but I feel like it was something that was or that had steam, and then all of a sudden ran out of steam. Nobody talks about it anymore. Nobody talks about trying to build this vision of everybody playing a 4-3-3 and blah 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 and all of a sudden that kind of just faded into the darkness. Now, I think that was an attempt at what you're trying to say of kind of having like a roadmap or a plan, whether flawed or not, but it had, you know, minimal existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can have a plan, but implementing that plan is key, and having people that are good at being able to, once again, articulate your vision and spread it to the masses is important. You know, and I asked you the question, you know, do they want to be led? Do they want to have these things, to a certain extent, forced upon them and say, look, this is the way that it's going, and this is the ruling body, if you will, and all of this stuff is going to trickle down? Or are they just fine being left to their own devices, and I don't care what you say, you really have no impact on whether I'm going to do my job, and as a matter of fact, maybe you're even putting challenges that I didn't have before or constraints that I didn't have before to be able to do my job. And this gets into the whole, you know, youth soccer structure and what is really at stake and what are people really doing when they're coaching, and what should the aspirations be for a player within a team or that coach that is coaching that player, and the help, and how much is winning important, and the money, and all that kind of stuff that we could talk about for hours, I'm sure.
No, and I like the direction that this is kind of going now. And I recently made a trip to Spain, and while I was there, I took a coaching course, and I asked the instructor if youth teams, and I'm talking about, you know, from the recreational level onward feel like they have a responsibility to support the national team.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yes, wholeheartedly believe that everybody in Spain is working to produce players for the national team and to make sure that they win consistently and they win with a certain style. And
they understand what that style is. Once again, they understand what that style is. And there is ownership there that, as you mentioned, I think it's too fragmented when it comes to the United States soccer landscape out there. And I think if you asked U.S. youth coaches, I think you would get a bunch of different answers, and many of which would be, no, that's not my responsibility at all. But making sure that people understand and have that type of ownership, that's another, you know, that's a whole nother kettle there. And you got to be able to. I don't think we have done it on a consistent basis, or maybe found the proper way to incentivize and make sure that it gets done. Because without it, you don't have it. And you could look at Germany and the way that their league partnered with their federation. And right now, when you talk about the United States Soccer Federation and MLS, for example, never has in MLS's existence it been more fractured. And I don't think we've ever had a coach that more openly has been anti-MLS than Jurgen Klinsmann. And that's not necessarily a good thing either for our continued evolution. And I think Jurgen would probably argue that it is done with a purpose. But I think at times it's much more detrimental than he even realizes.
You said a key word that I think it now is going to open the can of worms that a lot of people want us to talk about and want more of a conversation of, but incentivize. Mm-hmm. And the biggest incentive, in my opinion, for any player, any coach, any team in the United States would be the opportunity to move up based on merit to a domestic National League's first division, promotion relegation. I think, in my opinion, that is the biggest carrot that you can dangle in front of any youth coach, any youth player, any professional coach. And that is, in my opinion, what is missing. Incentives, whether it be money or that opportunity to move up. I think that's the biggest fracture in our federation right now. I don't know if I've ever heard you say yes or no to whether or not you believe in promotion and relegation. I've heard you give explanations of why it may work or why it may not work, but I don't know if I've ever heard you say yes, you believe in it, or no, you do not.
Do I believe in it? Yeah. I believe that promotion and relegation is a wonderful thing. I have no problem with promotion and relegation. I enjoy watching leagues that have promotion and relegation.
Do you not want that excitement in the United States?
No, I don't need it. That's what I'm saying. I don't need promotion relegation in order to enjoy my soccer. So when I think about promotion relegation, I also think about the realities of the situation in the moment. So how would you go about implementing promotion relegation right now with the currently existing situation that we have?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
No, and that's it's an incredibly difficult conversation to have. Do I think that I'm the person to mastermind or architect this new structure? No, I don't think so. Do I think that we can come in and lay our foot down and say this is going to happen next year? No way. I think it has to be leaked out over 3, 5, 7 years and give these guys that have been investors in Major League Soccer for many, many, many years, and that's a question or a topic I want to get into in just a second with you, but give these guys the opportunity to get their ducks in a row and know that, hey, these people are coming for you now, and it's going to be competitive. Now, whether that's 5 years, 7 years from now, but I think the longer and longer we wait to set that goal of implementing, of U.S. Soccer implementing a promotion relegation system, I think we're just, in my opinion, delaying the inevitable. I think it's going to happen. So why not start now?
Well, it's if you're saying you tear it down now, okay, what has already been built up.
I'm not saying tear it down. I'm saying prepare it for battle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at it from an ownership standpoint, why would you add additional risk to something that is already a risky proposition, number one? And I think even most promotion relegation folks recognize that there is a business reality when it comes to the way that MLS is set up and to the way that ownership looks at something like adding promotion relegation in terms of adding additional risk to the existing partners and to people that that continue to come in. And I always tell people, look, if you want this to happen, then go ahead, build it alongside what is already in existence. Now, if you believe that in order to go forward, you have to go back, you have to take a step back in order to go two steps forward, okay, I understand that. But I think too much time and effort and resources has been put into, let's say, for example, the current system, I don't know what we're going to call it here, but certainly in MLS and everything else, to tear it down right now. And if you are going to implement it, I could certainly see an MLS version of it where you have MLS 1 and MLS 2, but I know a lot of promotion relegation folks look at that as a bastardized version of it, and it's not real promotion relegation, and so that wouldn't even be enough. But okay. Maybe a hybrid type of scenario does exist in the future where you can have the best, I guess, of both worlds.
Real quick, if we go MLS 1, MLS 2, the incentive on paper, obviously, would be okay. You get the chance to move up into MLS 1, and the penalty is moving down to MLS 2. But what's really on the line there? That's when you talk about bastardizing something. What's really on the line for those people? What's the punishment of being in MLS 2? Do all those players get
to play against the best teams, and therefore your gate is going to suffer, and your image is going to suffer because you're not playing against the big teams in MLS 1, and so that's what theoretically would suffer.
But if it's a closed league of 40 teams or a closed system of 40 teams, that just, again, starts to beg the question, are those the best 40 teams in the United States? Are those the best groups of players in the United States if nobody else can break into that 40 teams?
Got it. So go build a better mousetrap. That's what America's about. I mean, if that's the way that you feel it should be done, then nobody is stopping you from going and doing it.
What does that look like on a global stage? And not to say that we should be, you know, that worried what it looks like, but I can't off the top of my head think of any major soccer playing nation that has two federations. What does that look like to the rest of the world? And how does that go? How do we move into a World Cup? Do we have two United States teams?
I don't think that is a possible situation. But ultimately in this country, and I'm not just talking about soccer, just in general, if you build something, a better product, and oftentimes people that are arguing promotion relegation will tell me that this is going to have a better product, and this is going to be better for the consumer, and this is going to be better soccer because of, like you mentioned, all the different things that I fully recognize and respect and accept are part of promotion relegation. So if that is the case, then the market will dictate it, and it will sort it out, and the cream will rise, and everything else that maybe will have been in place for many years will go off to the wayside because nobody will want to go and see it.
The theory of the cream will rise is a funny one. Right now, because of the current system, cream cannot rise. And I don't know if people really grasp onto that. Cream kind of just gets stirred around in a pot, at the top level, and it's going to stay there. That cream is it could be shit cream, and it's going to stay in that same pot. So I don't understand that the cream will rise right now.
Well, no, I mean cream can rise in the form of expansion, and you know, as you mentioned, that expansion may get to the point where you are starting to segment off into two different divisions or three different divisions as you continue to go. So the cream will be able to rise at a certain point. And if you are economically sound and you are attractive to the current MLS ownership group, then your cream will able to rise in that you are invited into, as we know, a club. And yes, it is closed. You can't just do it at your whim or just by winning a lot of games, but then your cream has risen to continue to this metaphor, and your cream has risen and you involve in MLS, and then more and more people, their cream rises and they are invited into MLS, at which point you start making it into those divisions that people have wanted all along. But once again, it is in that type of closed system, which I know brings us right back to where we started, where people are saying yes, but you don't have that freedom that exists in other leagues and in other countries around the world.
Alexi, my brain is spinning right now, and I'm going to submit to you right now.
Sure.
I would support a closed MLS promotion relegation system if there were four leagues. MLS 1, 2, 3, 4, all having 20 teams. Is that fair?
Oh, okay. All right. So it's just, I mean, I think what you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that we can find some sort of common ground. And I think we have in many instances. And I think that this is one of them. And ultimately, we want to get to a point where teams are able to work their way up to what we would consider a higher level. And even if it's within a closed system, but maybe that system exists with 60 teams or whatever, 50 teams or anything like that, but within there you have a 1, 2, and 3, and 4, I would have no problem with that. But in order to get to that 4, you can't just make the jump immediately to that 4. You have to bring in people, because part of the reason why MLS has been successful and has survived and in many cases thrived is because of prudent choices from an economic standpoint, a business standpoint, and making sure that they don't bring people in that are just going to be fly by night and they're just not going to have the means to continue when the rough times come. And the rough times always come.
And another thing that I would add to my submission, and this is, I've never thought about this before, to be honest. I'm off the cuff right now. I would be more interested in a MLS 1, 2, 3, 4, if there were 80 teams, 20 teams, a proper table. If one of the limitations was you had to actually prove your business choices going into your jumping into MLS 4 or something like that. So you're choosing a Detroit City FC that's already existing, or a Cincinnati, or so on. So that would be the requirement, is that you can't just be a team out of thin air. Would that be fair?
Yes, that would be definitely fair. Yeah, I mean, I think there is value, and I think an MLS ownership group would recognize the value in an established brand and recognize the value in, from a community perspective and from a business perspective, of having teams that have a history, that have an existence, that are on the ground. So I would have no problem with that.
Alexi, we've hit the hour and 30 minute mark. much longer than I actually anticipated getting with you, and like I kind of told you in the pre-interview, I have no idea why you guys make time for this small podcast.
I enjoy talking.
Yeah,
I enjoy talking with people like you. And as I tell all of the people that I do talk to, you know, while many of us that kick the soccer ball get a tremendous amount of credit for the growth and the evolution of this sport in this country, the reality is that people like you and men and women that we have nothing to do necessarily with watching on television and seeing us kick the ball around deserve as much. And you might think that you're doing a small thing, but it's part of this American soccer community that I love. You might think that this isn't important or impactful, but it is, and I want you to continue to do it. We can disagree, we can argue, we can have different ways of thinking about the game, but I think ultimately in our core, we all believe and love this game, and we want it to be successful in the United States. And we are all pulling and pulling and pushing and doing all different things to make that happen. And like I said, we have different ideas about how it should happen, but I think ultimately it's what I love about this American soccer community is that it is so diverse and it has so many different ideas and it is so passionate. And I know and I can feel your passion coming through. And so don't ever lose that, my friend. All right.
Yeah. And I have to say real quick, I think a round two is needed, and I hope you'll accept an invitation in the future to come back on. I think we were just getting into kind of the meat of things, but
We'll do a special media one, and my persona and my personality and character on air and all that. And I'm sure you got a lot of questions about that.
So there it was, my interview with Alexi Lawless. And I warned you guys it was going to come to a very abrupt end. I apologize for that. But I think that we got an hour and 30 minutes worth of some solid soccer talk. I think so. I do think that. Now, I have to say, after going back and during editing and listening to this and thinking about it, what the fuck was I thinking saying that I would agree with an 80-team pro-rel system sponsored by MLS? I admitted to it. I said it. In the moment, I was thinking off the top of my head, oh, man, yeah, that sounds great. No way. No way that sounds great. Oh, my gosh. But like I said, I think conversations like this are important. Throwing ideas out there like that are important. Maybe somebody sitting in that boardroom hears this conversation and says, yeah, sure, an 80-team MLS pro-rel system might work. And then somebody else says, no, it's still a closed system. I don't know. It's 2 o'clock in the morning now when I'm recording this, and I don't know what I'm saying. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I will talk to you guys again on the next episode. Thank you, and goodbye.
And John, I just want to remind you and all of your listeners that they can catch me this weekend, Sunday, big matchup. The New York Red Bulls are hosting NYCFC in a big, I don't know what we call it, a derby or a darby or whatever you call it. It's a big old rivalry, and I would feel remiss if I didn't mention that. So I want to keep my bosses at Fox happy. So you can turn in this weekend at 12:30 Eastern on Big Fox, on Bart Simpson Fox. So a big old soccer game happening this weekend. And thanks again for having me on your pod.